Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're talking with John Avlon. He's the editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast, and he's also the author of the great new book, Washington's Farewell, The Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations. John, thanks for talking to us.
Hey, Nick, sure.
So I want to get right to it. You talked in the book about Washington's farewell address, which is more kind of known in the abstract and in the presence. I want to hear you talk about why it's important that we read the whole 6,000-word bit today. But you talk about how Washington used his farewell address to proclaim first principles that could offer enduring solutions, the pursuit of peace through strength, the wisdom of moderation, the importance of virtue and education to a self-governing people, as he established the precedent of the peaceful transfer of power. So I guess my first question is, how did Washington know that what was going to happen in 2016?
I'm not sure his crystal ball was that good, but John Adams famously said that there hasn't yet been a democracy that didn't die by suicide. Every attempt at a democratic republic had ended into failure. And what I don't think we adequately appreciate today is that the founding fathers were very consciously drawing on history, an understanding of how democratic republics had failed in the past, in an attempt to solve for some of those problems. They did not have perfect crystal balls. They couldn't have imagined necessarily America in 2017, of course. But they were trying to tap into deeper truths, eternal principles. And that's why what's so fascinating about the farewell, it's this memo from the first founding father to future generations, in which he is consciously trying to marry the past, the present of 1796, and the future. And the forces that have destroyed democratic republics in the past are eerily prescient. The big three forces are hyperpartisanship, excessive debt, and foreign wars. And that's just a reminder of that, you know, we in America are a relatively young country still, but we do not exist on a plane larger than history and the larger forces of civilization. And as we think about our country as a civilization, as something to protect, defend, expand, to understand that these are forces that when we play with them, when we get too careless, rationalizing hyperpartisanship, for example, as an extension of ideological debates, that we're tapping into something deeply dangerous that has destroyed democratic republics in the past.
Discuss a little bit about what a giant role Washington's farewell address played for 100 or 150 years in American historiography, and you talk about it as, I think, brilliantly, as the Old Testament for American civic religion, and the Gettysburg Address is kind of the New Testament. Yeah. But talk about the vast influence that it had for so many years.
That's part of what makes it such a great story, is that the farewell address was more widely reprinted than the Declaration of Independence for the first 100 years of our republic. It was civic scripture. It was called upon at all times. Civic leaders would try to hold up their decisions and conduct active arguments about great debates through its lens. And then it fell out of favor beginning in World War I. But
did it fall out of favor for ideological reasons, or did what replaced it?
Well, one could argue nothing. It was largely the debate around World War I. Where Woodrow Wilson squares off against Henry Cabot Lodge, senator from Massachusetts, both Washington biographers, by the way. And the whole debate about whether America should get involved in a continental war, that itself seems to ignore Washington's advice in fundamental ways. The League of Nations, which was ultimately, you know, Cabot won that round, was rejected largely on people saying we need to remember Washington's...
And because we shouldn't have been in World War I, the League of Nations... Part of what Washington talks about is those enduring alliances, like we should not be involved one way or the other.
Right, and you know, it's funny because Washington's farewell, I think, has been willfully misinterpreted and misunderstood often as an endorsement of isolationism. It is not. But what he sets forward is a philosophy of independence and a foreign policy of independence. And that's what I think, you know, can't be appreciated enough. You know, Will Rogers used to have a great line that America has the two greatest friends that any country ever had. You know, they are the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean. There was enormous strategic benefit at being separated from the turmoils of Europe. Now, of course, at some point, you know, technology shrinks the tyranny of distance, and there are limits to applicability, but principles are meant to guide us. They're not, you know, rigid straitjackets. But you asked how the farewell address impacted and was used throughout American history. Jefferson is Washington's ultimate frenemy. They are squaring off, and Jefferson, with great duplicity, is funding a newspaper out of his State Department to attack Washington's administration because Washington refuses to sign up with the French Revolution. And Washington very much wants us to walk a middle ground between the monarchy and the mob. And he and Hamilton and Adams are horrified by the new type of tyranny the French Revolution represents. Jefferson is enthralled by it and thinks, you know, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet, and we're expanding the Empire of Liberty, and all that bloodshed is just part of the cost. And that's when the French also start trying to infiltrate domestic politics. And one of the things that blew my mind is Washington so much in the farewell is warning against foreign influence in domestic politics.
You know what? That has no relevance today.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
But you know, and it's because this was part of the stories about how democratic republics had been weakened in the past by states infiltrating themselves into debate, confusing people about real national self-interest, and then leaving them divided and weak. And liable to conquer. So Putin didn't come up with the playbook himself. It was a longstanding thing that Washington wrestled with. When Jefferson, however, takes the oath of office, he becomes a born-again Washingtonian. The phrase entangling alliances is his, does not appear in the farewell address. Andrew Jackson's farewell address is almost entirely a riff off Washington's farewell address, warning his fellow citizens, saying that when Washington wrote this only 20 years after the Declaration, we didn't know if the Constitution would succeed. Now we do, but let's not be lulled into the false idea that we can indulge the forces that will lead to civil war, because Washington was eminently focused on national unity, that he understood that our independence as a nation was inseparable from our interdependence as a people. And so Jackson is hammering away at that. And Lincoln in 1860, part of his standard stump speech was a riff off the farewell address. He requires that the farewell address be read aloud to troops during the Civil War to remind them what they're fighting for. And after the Civil War, the farewell address is deployed in public schools to help reunite the nation. But it is true that over time, the Gettysburg Address takes over the place it's held. And the reason I say that it's the Old Testament is that Washington's farewell address is these rules of behavior dispatched by a distant God. It is, here is how to, the principles to hew to remain a strong, vibrant democratic republic. But it can be tough going. It's over 6,000 words. The Gettysburg Address is this poetic rumination of life after death, and it's 272 words, and a lot easier to memorize in schools. And so farewell address falls away, the Gettysburg Address takes over.
How do you think Obama's farewell address stacks up? And it's unfair to, this is, the greatest hit of all time in many ways, but yeah. Was he consciously striking notes from Washington's farewell, or was it disconnected?
Very explicitly, he quoted Washington's farewell address in the speech and in Chicago that night. To some extent, like inaugurals, farewell addresses are conversations across the generations. And Washington set the mold there as well, because he decides to issue the presidential warning. You know, the farewell address isn't this valedictory victory lap where he talks about all the great things he did. It's specifically a warning to his fellow citizens about the forces that could destroy our democratic republic and had in the past. And so when Eisenhower does his, I think, the other greatest farewell address, it's a warning about the rise of the military-industrial complex, which in the original draft was the military-industrial congressional complex. And he builds it explicitly on the model of Washington's farewell. We have memos that I include in the book, because there's a chapter on the afterlife of the idea. Obama was unusually, not exclusively, quoted directly from the Washington's farewell address. And it was to make the point of national unity, and to also, I think, his great threat, his warning to us and future generations, was that democracy is not a given. It was threats to democracy. That was the flow through he warned about. When you look about the rise of what may be called illiberal democracy or soft authoritarianism that we're dealing with right now, the reaction to globalization, not only the rise of Islamist terrorism, but these ethno-nationalist political movements, they're all contained, and that's what he was warning about.
So let's talk about it in the contemporary context, because it is stunning, and it's not simply Donald Trump. I mean, there's a global
Sure.
phenomenon going on. There are Democrats who are sounding economic nationalist Yeah. Sentiments almost as loudly as Trump himself. But we've got hyperpartisanship, we've got debt up the wazoo, and we've got alliances that have been longstanding that are either strategically dubious. I mean, and you and I might disagree about, say, NATO or the role of NATO, but people are questioning
that. That's probably one of the few areas we do disagree on.
But certainly people are talking about these. How do we pull back on the partisanship that is bad? Because there is, you know, we do want to have ideological differences that we discuss.
We want to have vigorous debate, right? I mean, dissent is essential to democracy. But this is something that I think you and I have both written books about in the past. Washington is the first and to date only independent president. He was not a member of political party as a matter of principle. And people forget this, that the Constitution itself doesn't mention political parties. It only seems like they're the purpose of our politics. They're not. It does mention journalists, which I think is worth remembering. But it doesn't mention political parties. And part of the reason that Washington was in great psychic and physical pain at the time of the farewell address was that he was watching his two most talented surrogate sons in the cabinet, Jefferson and Hamilton, start to seed these partisan forces. And he could see them tearing apart the country. And he warned particularly against regional political parties, because that would lead to civil war potentially. But also taking notes from ancient Greece and Rome, he warned against, you know, what they called faction, political factions, but we could all call hyperpartisanship. And one of the explicit riffs he hits that is so prophetic is he says that when a country becomes consumed with partisan rivalry, the result is a deadlocked democracy. That creates a real resentment on the part of frustrated citizens who see their government not being efficient or effective.
Or representative.
Or representative, exactly. And that, he warned, could open the door to a demagogue with authoritarian ambitions.
And I guess it also, in the contemporary context, a deadlocked Congress, and I'm not sure that I want them to be active, but it leads to a place where we now have two-thirds of our federal spending is on autopilot. It's entitlements and interest on the debt, and we're not going to do anything about that. So that's the next thing.
There's been a complete capitulation, and this is something that I'm really passionate about, and has an entire chapter in the book, because Washington was very clear about the fact, as was Hamilton, that excessive debt was a force that topples empires. But excessive is the key. Washington was actually allergic to debt. He thought it was an insult to self-sufficiency, and indeed it can be. But you know, Washington and Hamilton get this sort of philosophical mind meld beginning in the Revolution. It wasn't just because there was a weak and ineffectual Continental Congress. It was that the currency was so debased that they could not buy basic munitions, right? And so getting loans from France and the Netherlands was essential. And Robert Morris first, and then Hamilton, really became disciples of the necessity of fiscal discipline, but that a degree of debt could be a great thing for a young nation, a degree of debt. And that's the key caveat. And Washington edits these lines very carefully to show that he's not, and he's won over by Hamilton on this, he's not opposed to all debt, but when it becomes excessive, when we pass on to the posterity those debts that we ought to pay ourselves, generational responsibility, that's when it becomes untenable. And he says, look, you're going to have to man up and deal with the math and pay taxes. It's not pleasant, but you're going to need to do it. And that's another reason to be very wary of wars, you know, because it's not only blood, it's also treasure. But again, these are historical forces he's engaging with, and they're forces that we have begun to view as remote and distant. But history usually has the last laugh. So that's why there's an urgency in listening to them again.
So bring it up to it's not entangling alliances, but it is, treaties, mutual defense. How do we deal with that now in a context using Washington as a lens?
I think, again, it's a lens with which to guide us.
Yeah, it's not set prescriptions, do this
right,
and don't do
because
that.
Because as brilliant as they were, I'm going to assume they could not have anticipated, you know.
Drones, supersonic, ICBMs, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, the safety that the ocean provided us for a time militarily does not exist. But Washington wanted to take advantage of that so we could grow in strength militarily, economically. He actually was very much an advocate of a fairly expansive vision of commercial ties with all nations, political ties with none. What he was trying to do was make sure that our decisions were rooted in our self-interest. And what he was very wary of was young nations becoming a pawn in larger games.
That does not sound different from the way Donald Trump talks.
So this is an area where some Trump supporters might really be able to identify. And part of my hope with Washington's farewell address is that it remains a document that can unite us, left, right, libertarian, center, that it can provide a sense of common ground and common purpose. And there are things that would appeal to some Donald Trump supporters. I think if you talk to them, or, you know, he wouldn't use a phrase like non-interventionist like Rand Paul and many libertarians, but he would also reject, despite, you know, the invocation of the America First legacy, which itself is wrapped up in Washington, of isolationism. But Washington, you know, the first battle he's involved in as a young soldier kicks off the French and Indian War. So he understands the interconnectedness. He's under no illusions, but he's also not under any illusion that any other's nation's self-interest should be mistaken for our own. And what he doesn't want, and what the two parties get formed as, are basically proxies of France and or England. And he insists on a proclamation of neutrality because he doesn't want us to become overwhelmed. He wants us time to grow in strength, economically, militarily, and he's warning very consistently that we can't get off center in our politics, in our finances, or in our foreign affairs.
Well, you know, centrism or moderate, I mean, would you consider yourself a political moderate or a political centrist? How do you define yourself?
Sure.
I mean, it really, in many ways, it's the great theme of your work. And, you know, books, early books like Wingnuts, which were about how extremists, you know, Glenn Beck's and the Keith Olbermans of the world were part of the problem. I mean, you're kind of sounding a similar note in through a different venue here.
That is very much intentional. Yeah. It's what I believe, and I think it's a flow through of much of my work, not all of it. My first book, Independent Nation. I am a proud centrist. I'm an independent as a matter of principle. One of the things I think we also forget is that moderation was a virtue to the founding fathers, particularly Washington. Moderation was a source of strength as a governing principle, because when we became immoderate, and this was rooted in classical wisdom, the golden mean, you know, avoid the extremes. This was also the living memory of how England had degenerated into civil war, that when extreme factions start polarizing and demonizing fellow citizens, right, when they undermine the idea of assuming a common ground and common good, that's when democracies fall apart. And Washington was he had a great phrase called pretend patriots. It was the people who would try to divide fellow Americans against each other while trying to pretend that they're representing our deepest traditions and true interests. And he called them pretend patriots, and I think that is a useful phrase to remember from time to time.
So would you like today's independents or moderates or centrists to be called Washingtonians?
I think that is the right banner for us to unite and fight under. I do. You know, it's a strong plurality of Americans who believe ultimately that there's more than unites us than divides us as Americans. And I think what we need to do is not have moderation as a principle of governing, which is not mushy middle split the difference. It's let's try to define the common ground. Let's root our policies in our best, deepest traditions. Let's balance individual liberty and generational responsibility. That tension is what makes free government work.
So what does that mean with something, say, like entitlement reform? Because, you know, and from a libertarian perspective, I think we're past the entitlement era. We can't afford it because the finances don't work out. It's part of the 19th century. It's you know, it's a German invention. It's not going to work anymore. I suspect you would be less willing to say, okay, let's get rid of entitlements. But, you know, how do you come up with a moderate social safety, or what do you do with? I mean, like,
sure.
Put some bone or so, put so, some meat
so
on your bones.
So first of all, I think the guiding principle of trying to balance individual liberty and generational responsibility is right, and I think generational responsibility, that argument directly addresses out of control deficits and debt, the prime driver of which is entitlements. I think, you know, you need to do things that allow a weaning off, but it's under the spirit of generational responsibility, not fiscal austerity for its own sake. It's about looking for the long-term strength of a republic, not being undermined. So you need to deal with those things. You cannot pretend they don't matter. You cannot pretend that they're an esoteric concern. It's very real, and it can happen very quick. You know, the ancient Greeks, quote unquote, invented democracy, and they've had a real hard time with it, in part because of excessive debt and a culture that's, I think, been too driven by these
considerations. To go to this question of moderation, it's kind of interesting to think about. You worked with Rudolph Giuliani when
Proudly.
He was, yeah, Rudy Giuliani in New York. he is one of the least moderate people in American politics. I mean, when he was mayor of New York, and, you know, there were many things I didn't necessarily agree with him on, but he was the future of the Republican Party because he was a moderate Republican.
Right.
Then he became an ankle biter for Trump. Is he a cautionary tale?
Look, I had the privilege of being Rudy's chief speechwriter when he was mayor of New York and I was a young man. And I'm very proud of the work we did, and I think he saved New York City. And I think it's one of the great examples of effective governance that can occur from the center right. Now, to me, it was never incidental that he was a Republican. He was tough on crime. He, you know, crime and welfare were cut in half under his tenure. He showed that New York City could be governed again. But he was pro-choice. He was pro-gay rights. He was pro-immigrant. And he never wavered from those things. That, to me, is a vision of the vital center, and that applies to cities in particular. We obviously disagree about Donald Trump. I think he ran a divisive, demagogic campaign. I also believe that good people can disagree. I think our politics are in very different places at the moment, but I'm enormously proud. And I think that it would be a great disservice to the country, to the city, if this chapter were used to define him, because there are plenty of his political enemies when he really did challenge, I think, a very sclerotic orthodoxy. In that was really driving down people's sense of civic investment. And a lot of that involved taking on big liberal bureaucracies and other things. If the chapter is used to define him, then we will lose some degree of access to that really effective and important chapter. And he deserves all the credit for that.
At the Daily Beast, you guys are kicking ass. I write for you. So obviously, I think it's a wonderful publication. So I can possibly only to reason. What are the things that excite you the most about covering news, politics, and culture in the Trump era?
Well, our mission is clear. I think that's the thing, that there is no ambiguity as to the purpose of working in the free press right now.
What do you mean by that?
Well, look, I think we need to hold power to account. That's a constant. You need to respect the office of president, but relentlessly hold the individuals occupying the White House at any given time accountable. The larger forces he has tapped into, you know, from the broader wave of ethno-nationalism, which I think is deeply disturbing and does not represent our best traditions, and you can call it populism, conservative populism, but it is predicated upon the demagogue's telltale equation, which is us against them. That, I think, is the opposite of our best traditions as a country. And as journalists, I think it is absolutely key that we step up our game. It is a more dangerous environment. When the President of the United States is calling journalists the enemy of the American people, it's almost a cartoon, but it's very real. So you go into work every day with a real sense of mission, with a sense of clarity, and a sense that democracy cannot be taken for granted. And that, you know, you still need to make sure you're entertaining as you educate. We want to draw people in. We want to make sure that, you know, we have a very young audience, but we don't dumb it down for them. And what I love about the Daily Beast is that, you know, we're at the intersection of politics and pop culture, but we love calling bullshit on bullies, bigots, and hypocrites. We are nonpartisan but not neutral. What that means is that we will punch both sides as the facts provide. We will insist on a fact-based debate. And that creates a dynamic mix with great columnists and great writers and real original reporting, which is sadly a differentiator today. And it allows us to, you know, more than double our traffic, more than 1 million people a day read the Daily Beast now, and I'm proud of that.
Well, congratulations on that. We will leave it there. We have been talking with John Avlon. He's the editor-in-chief of the Daily Beast, and he's the author most recently of the excellent book, Washington's Farewell, The Founding Fathers' Warning to Future Generations. John, thanks for
talking. Thanks, Nick.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening.